Welcome to Picture Book Path, a podcast for picture book writers and illustrators with questions about self-publishing. I'm Ijun.
And I'm Phil. We're two experienced image makers on a new journey to publish independent picture books.
There's no real map, and we don't know everything.
But we're asking questions and traveling this path to find answers.
Come explore with us. Hey, Phil, how's it going?
Hey, Ijun. I'm okay. How are you doing?
I'm good.
What have you been up to the last little while?
So I decided starting September 1st that I'm actually putting aside my children's book for a little bit.
Oh, wow. That's a big decision.
Yeah, I'm going to put it aside for probably this whole month and then reevaluate. But I felt like I need to switch gears and think a little bit more about some of the other art stuff I want to create for the holiday season. This is usually the time of year when I am preparing for craft shows, which have mostly, the in-person ones have mostly been canceled.
Right.
So I don't even know how it's going to go. And I've been semi-avoiding thinking about what I'm, what my plans are. But I decided I better start making some new art and just hope for the best, basically.
So, are you participating in any virtual shows?
I think I will be. Some of the shows that I normally take part in haven't sent those applications out yet. Some have. So I probably will. As I've said before, I work better like obsessively just working on something and then switching gears. And so I think it'd be better for me to just try to switch my brain and then go back and maybe mix it up and do a little bit of both, but just have this month to just like not worry about, am I getting any work done on the book?
Right. Yeah. And, if it causes you stress while you have to be productive in other areas, it's not going to help anything. Yeah.
Which, and I know for you, I mean, you're constantly having to be productive in other areas. So I don't even know how you do that, because keeping your foot in the other picture book world is like, it's hard to do consistently, I think, when you have other work going, other kind of art stuff going on, like get your head to even think about all those different things. But
yeah. Right now I'm playing a little bit of whack-a-mole, right? Where like after we're done recording today, I have to make some revisions for some marketing copy that I wrote for a client and then do some illustration stuff. So yeah, I'm kind of scattered. I'm all over the place.
I don't know about you, but I find it hard to like do the business side and the creative side at the same time. I think it's like much easier to sort of separate them. Do you find that or?
Well, so I know there are
I guess I'm thinking of marketing, the sort of businessy, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, I don't market myself nearly well enough. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of writers say that they will actually break up the week where, say, Mondays are the day they work on marketing or something like that.
Yeah.
And they actually try and schedule it out that way just so that they have a time that forces them into doing it. They get it done and then they can move on to other stuff.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I haven't found a way that works really well for me yet. Because I'm always distracted by whatever I'm not working on, I'm distracted by it while I'm working on other things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, yes. I work better being obsessed, because I can be totally obsessed, get it done, and then it's out, and then obsess on something else.
Right.
But yeah, if something's in the back of your head, it's hard. Are you working on your picture book at all or on the
not
other?
Not enough. So with the picture book project, I've been doing a lot of planning and thinking and things like that. And just trying to figure out, I think I mentioned last episode, just trying to figure out what it is I need to do in terms of business and all that kind of stuff. Up until now, I've been a sole proprietorship, meaning I just work as a freelancer under my own name.
Yes.
And I've been thinking about maybe for this book stuff, I should form an LLC and I need to come up with a name for an imprint, right? That's going to be publishing my books.
Oh, yeah.
And, mm-hmm. you know, just all of those in a way, like separating out the businessy stuff from the creative stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's actually one of the things that I've been trying to focus on, is just figuring out what I should be doing and when I should be doing it. I haven't made any more progress on the artwork for my book because I am illustrating a book right now for a nonprofit called Richmond Young Writers that does classes and workshops for teenagers and kids here in Richmond. Every year, they do a picture book project where students write books and illustrators in the community illustrate those books. So I did one last year. I'm doing another one this year. So I'm working on this pretty hilarious book written by a teenager. But the deadline for that is next week. So I got to finish that up.
Yeah. Is it going pretty well, though?
Yeah. It's going along fine. You know, there's a bit of a time crunch on it. There's not a ton of time to work on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling a little bit like Bonnie, our previous guest, who's an illustrator, who's like, oh, I did this book in 3 weeks. I've done this one over the course of 2 months about, yeah. And I'm illustrating and designing it. And another thing that has been interesting is that when I'm designing the text layout for it, I have a completely different philosophy than our previous guest, Larry Issa. Do you remember he's graphic design and he's saying that he likes to make all of his text pretty straightforward so that if one word gets a little bit gimmicky, that word sticks out, right? Like if it's at a slant or slightly larger.
Yeah.
But I started my career in independent comics. And, you know, in comic books, there are sound effects that like take on the shape of the sound that they're making. And, you know, like there's the caption font, and then there's a separate dialogue font and all that kind of stuff. And it just makes comic books really dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I tend to do picture books that benefit from also having dynamic text.
Yeah.
You know, Larry Issa does, he's like quiet, kind of elevated picture books. And I'm whizzing out picture books. And so my text is like, takes on all kinds of different shapes and colors and things like that.
No, I mean, that's cool. I mean, the truth is, like, in this podcast, we're going to speak with so many people, and they all have different takes on what they think is successful. And the best thing is, like, see where they're coming from. But if you like a different style, that's your style, and you at least know why you're doing that. And I think that's the most important, is like, you're doing it for a certain effect, and you like that effect. So you should just, you know, do what works for you.
Yeah. So that's the Richmond Young Writers project, is the one that I've been working on in terms of art the last little while. Yeah. It's going to be up for pre-order soon. I'll be sharing out links about it. When it's up for pre-order.
Awesome.
But in terms of my own project, I've been just thinking about businessy stuff, all the things to tackle. So feeling a little bit overwhelmed with all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that like once you get a little bit of a handle on it, it becomes like, okay, I get this is what works for me, or this is what I need to do. It's probably going to be a little overload at first, and I think that's just normal because it's not like, you know, it comes intuitively to most people.
Yeah. Like, and there's that learning curve. And as soon as you get it, you got it and you can move on to the next thing.
But we'll get there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you'll get there. So,
and you know, it's all just so different than what I normally do, right? Like I don't have to typically package an entire book project and figure out how to get it into bookstores and how to hand sell it and direct marketing versus going wide and getting into the libraries, you know, like, so it's just a lot of new stuff.
Right. And speaking of libraries,
you noticed I dropped the crumb and you picked it up.
But speaking of libraries, today we have a very special guest who Phil will tell you about right now.
Yeah. So today's guest I'm super excited about. It's Betsy Bird. She's the collection development manager at Evanston Public Library and the former youth material specialist of New York Public Library. She blogs frequently at the school library journal site, A Fuse Number 8 Production, and reviews for Kirkus and the New York Times on occasion. Betsy is the author of the picture book,
Giant Dance Party and The Great Santa Stakeout. She's also a co-author of the very adult Wild Things, Acts of Mischief in Children's Literature, editor of the middle grade anthology of funny female writers, Funny Girl, and author of her upcoming debut middle grade novel, Long Road to the Circus, which is illustrated by Caldecott Award-winning illustrator David Small. Betsy also hosts two podcasts, Story Seeds, which pairs kids and authors together to write stories, and the very funny Fuse 8 and Kate, where she and her sister debate the relative merits of classic picture books. So Betsy is all over the place. She does everything.
She does a lot. Yeah. She's and impressive. You've been a big fan of hers for a really long time.
I have. I'm a huge fanboy. And so I'm totally nervous about this whole thing.
You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. So let's bring Betsy out to talk about how you can get your independent books into libraries.
Hey, Betsy. Thanks for being here with us today.
Hey, Betsy.
Hello.
Yeah, it's so great to talk to someone else in the industry that's got like an insider track. So just kind of jumping in here, like as book people, we all love libraries. But none of us that aren't actually in the day-to-day running of a library know that much about how they work. How do libraries actually obtain their books? Like how do books get on the shelves?
So it's a good question, because back in the day, I think even maybe when I was in grad school, this might have been partly taught, which indicates the age and decrepitness of myself. But in the old days, you got all your review journals. You got your school library journal, your horn book. You got your, you know, your bulletin of the Center of Children's Books. You got, you know, school, yeah, all the things. And then you went through the reviews. Like you physically went through the reviews and went, well, that looks good. Maybe not that. And that looks good. Maybe we'll get two of those. And then you like, you know, like a rube, wrote them down and then like sent them off to a company like Baker and Taylor, who would procure them for you and send them to you. And maybe they'd put like labels on there for you. Maybe put the little Mylar cover on for you, or maybe not. Maybe they just send you the books and then you do that all in-house. That changed when I first became the youth material specialist for New York Public Library, where Baker and Taylor now was like, hey, we could just make virtual carts of books that had just gotten reviewed. So now here's all the books that have been reviewed that are picture books. Here's all the books that have been reviewed that are easy books. Here's all the middle grade novels. Here's all the nonfiction. And so it's so much easier, because then you just take look at the cart and you go, yes, no, 1, 2, 1, 3, 0, 0. You know, it's great. And then you send it off and they take care of it and they send them back. Now, I mean, the problem with that, of course, is it's just the reviewed titles. Libraries have always historically had the rule that if it isn't reviewed, it doesn't get in the library. But there are real equity issues with that. And so who gets the reviews? So that is all changing right now. But so, and also, Baker and Taylor doesn't have everything, particularly, again, equity issues. They often don't have books by, people of color, a lot of independently published things. So you kind of, back in the day, I'd sit on my butt and I wouldn't have to move. I just bit on my butt all day. And now I got to actually like physically get up and go and find some of these books and bring them into the library. So it's changed.
Wow. So yeah, we're still even in the process of change now.
Oh, very much so. This is a big moment of change. I mean, I don't know what they're teaching in the library grad schools right now, but they've got to be covering all this. They've got to be saying like, you know, we used to teach you this and now we're seeing that maybe we need to change our rules and maybe do more like this. So yeah.
Right.
We're in transition.
Well, so then when you say that you've got to like get up out of your chair and go look for the books, what strategies are you using to go?
Well,
look
I
for
say
books?
I do it, and I do it somewhat. So there's book fairs. You know, we have, we're actually hoping to start an Evanston Black Book Fair once a year, which would be fantastic. Oh, but cool. When I lived in New York, there was a Harlem Book Fair that happened every year. Chicago actually has a fair number of book fairs. So, what you get is people will take out booths and they'll, you know, and these will be, you know, either very small publishers or they'll be independently published books. And they will just display their books, or it'll be authors to be like, hey, I've got this book. And then you can physically go and you can see, and you can be like, oh, this actually fills a need that we didn't have before. And maybe we could get some of this. And there's a lot of local interest, which people in my locality are interested in. So there's that. Now, I should say also, I have at my library, we're very lucky because we have a Latinx outreach coordinator. She goes to Guadalajara to the book fair there, and she gets books for our library there, and then she flies back. She did that last year. This year, maybe not so much, but under normal circumstances, yeah, she flies there, gets a whole bunch of books, has them shipped back to the States, and we add those books, because the problem we have found with books in Spanish is a lot of them come from Spain. And that's not necessarily what we're looking for.
Right, yeah. Regional differences within language.
Exactly.
Wait, so Betsy, when you said you go to these book fairs and you see independent authors, so you have purchased independent books for the library?
Yes,
we have. Because they fill them. Wow, okay.
Yeah, and then sometimes if they live in my town, we'll have them come in and do programs. We'll be like, well, you live in Evanston, you have a book, let's do a program. It just makes sense. So yeah, it's a good way of sort of bringing in local interest while at the same time trying to make a more equitable collection.
Right. So that's where independent books can come in and help fill a need.
Absolutely.
Huh. So you're describing ways in which you're going out into the world and finding the books. Are there ways in which authors are coming to you?
Yes, that does happen. So because I review books on my blog, which is hosted by School Library Journal. And because of this, I also will put the reviews on Goodreads and I'll put them on Amazon. I hate Amazon, but I like the whole free review aspect of it. So if I write a review, I'm going to put, most people are going to go to Amazon. So why don't I just put my review there? I get the most amount of people reading. They're not going to go to, they're not going to find my blog. So they're going to go there and, or they're going to go to Goodreads. And as a result, I get a lot of people who come to me from those places. Hey, I saw that you reviewed this book on Goodreads. I have a book that's similar to it. Can I offer you a chance to look at my book? Sometimes they do know who I am and they do know my blog and they contact me that way. When my website's working, which it sometimes is and it's sometimes not, it's a crapshoot. Some people come through there as well and they'll email me through that location. Some people have direct messaged me through, you know, Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. So people come from all different directions when it comes to reaching out and saying, hey, do you want to consider my book either for the collection itself or for review? And I can't do them. I will tell them, I'm like, I cannot promise a review because I do like one review a week and they're long.
Right.
But I can at least promise to look at the book. If it's a really long, thick fantasy, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I can't, unless it's like, I start reading and it's like amazing, but I don't tell them that. the most I can say is like, I promise to look at it and consider it for other forms of promotion, possibly.
Right.
For example, I have one right here. I have Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imaginations Run Free, a coronavirus COVID-19 story for children. So now I'm getting like the coronavirus books being sent to me. So, you know, they reach out and I like to answer them. I won't answer them, I should say. If they email me and just say, hello, and they couldn't even be bothered to find out my name, then no. You're just sending or if it's clear that you just sent a form letter and you just plugged in a bunch of, because you can tell, then it's like, nah, you don't need me, buddy. But if they know who I am and they say, sometimes they'll say something like, I like how you do this. I'll be like, clever. I'll pay attention to you. All right.
Yeah, in a way, it's almost like approaching an agent with traditional publishing.
It's very similar. You have to work on your cover letter because if you don't, it's easy to cut to the chaff. Just tick,
tick, tick. Yeah.
Right. Well, you're so busy, right? So people don't want to give you an excuse to say no.
Exactly. Which needs to be taught, because some people give me an excuse to say no. Most people give me a very easy excuse to say no. They'll just say hello or Mr. That's a good one. I like that. Oh, Mr. Hughes number 8. I'm like, no.
Yeah, because you're going to be putting a lot of energy into what they're asking of you. They should be putting energy into asking you to do that. So,
well, and that's the thing. I mean, when you publish a book, and if you're doing it independently or with a small press or even with a big press that's so big that they're not doing the publicity push for you and you've got to do that work yourself, that's a full-time job. Yeah. And, you know, I know authors actually do turn it into a full-time job and reach out to schools and reach out to reviewers and reach out in all different ways. And yeah. I got nothing but respect for somebody who does that because I know how hard that is. Mm-hmm. A very wise author once told me that when you have a new book out, you do one thing for it every day. And I was like, that's very interesting, but a good advice.
You have several books out yourself through traditional publishers.
I do have several books out myself. Yes, I do. Yeah, I'm terrible at promotion. I'm awful at it. I hate asking for anything. So I'm just sort of like, I had a book. You want to see it? No, I don't even know. I don't even want to ask. I don't even want to ask. So what if they say no? And then I've got a new one with David Small coming out next year. So that should be good.
Oh, wow.
David Small was my local illustrator. He came into my fourth grade class when I was a kid and he drew. And he knew my mom at the bookstore. But it turns out he lives in a house that my grandma's no good uncle would visit instead of doing his farm chores because there was an ancient circus performer who lived there. So it's a whole thing. So I was like, that's a picture book. And I showed it to David Small and he was like, because it's his house, he lives there now. And he was like, yeah, no, that's a novel. And I was like, oh, so much longer.
Wow.
But it worked out.
So cool.
So is this your first novel length?
It is. It's my debut novel because I did do Funny Girl, but I was just the editor. I just found other brilliant people and I smooshed them all together in a book. And that's a great way to make a book. I don't know why everyone doesn't just do that. It's like, look, I got a Raina Telgemeier and a Shannon Hallett. Yay, book. But no, this I actually had to write the words myself. More of them than just the Mad Libs for Funny Girl. Yeah. You know, hey, it's a book. It's coming out. It's it's with Knopf. So I love to say Knopf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gotta hit that K.
Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations. It sounds really interesting.
So when indie authors approach you, what kind of thing are you looking for? Like what's the sort of thing they could say to you that shows that they're a professional or gets them past your first filters?
That's a really good question. Okay, my name is great. An awareness that I'm female, so right there, that's very good. And then it's nice if they say something personal about my blog, my reviews, my work, being a librarian, just to show they did the basic rudimentary research on who is this person. Also, and this is key, if they know what kind of book I tend to review. So if they're coming at me with YA, I don't touch the stuff. That's verboten. That's outside my range. I will touch everything up until YA. I'll even do middle school, but it's catchy. But yeah, just knowing what the person does and reviews and does not review. Again, just basic research. And then something about the book that gets my attention is great. What makes it different from the 500 back to school books that we see every year? It's okay, your book's about the tooth fairy. Why is your tooth fairy different? What can you say about your book that sells it? I mean, it's the elevator pitch, right? What's your elevator pitch? What about your book is different from all the similar books in the same vein? Because there's really only so many topics in the world of children's books. Yeah. So why, I mean, Harry Potter was a kid who went to wizarding school. We'd had that before, many times before, but she did it different and she did it really well. So why is your book essentially the Harry Potter of whatever topic that you're writing?
Yeah. And do you want inclusion of things like ISBN numbers?
To some extent, if the book has an ISBN, that shows a level of professionalism. So it wouldn't be the worst thing to mention just when you have, like, if you have in the email, like the stats for your book, like this is the page count, this is the illustrator, this is me, the author, or maybe I'm the illustrator. And this is the ISBN, particularly if you don't include the cover. I like it when people include the cover of their books in the emails, because right away I can sort of tell what kind of book we're dealing with. If you don't include the cover, I am going to go to Amazon, plug in the name of the book. And if I can't find it, that's going to be a problem. But if you have the ISBN, then I can look that up. And maybe even if I can't find it on Amazon, if I go on the web and I put in the ISBN, maybe you've got a link to it on your site and I can see it there. So whatever helps me when I'm making my decisions is very useful.
How does procurement happen? Like, is it you that's doing the the ordering online itself or that sort of thing.
Yes. Now, well, here's the deal. The reason that libraries like to work with businesses like Ingram, like Baker and Taylor, like Follett, is that they do all the hard work for you. It comes down to payment. Payment is so tricky for libraries. We don't have time to go to a bunch of little individual sites and fill out paperwork for every single one of these different vendors every time we want to get a book. So Baker and Taylor says, great, just buy through us. You'll pay us. We'll pay the vendor on or the publisher on your behalf, which is wonderful. Now, when we get around that, that means I find, there's a tiny publisher called Path Press. They have books that are amazing about, Black Evanstonians, which is like the golden, this is what I want the most for my library. Right. So what I have to do is they have to fill out a vendor form, literally have to fill out a form and send it back to me so that I basically have permission to buy from them. It's an extra step. If I was a huge system like New York Public Library or Chicago Public Library, I literally would not have the time to do this. So I just would,
right.
I would only work with the vendors. And so there might be some unspoken rule there. Like you can't buy independently from individual, a lot of these small presses don't want to be on Amazon because Amazon takes a huge cut.
Right.
Plus, but Amazon is probably already set up with these libraries. We know how to buy, we have an account with Amazon. So, but I am sympathetic to people who don't want to use it because it's evil. So so I will go to the individual publisher, but I do have to say to them, please fill out the vendor form. If they're ignoring me, if they don't get back to me, if they don't send me back that form, I can't buy from them. I can't get the book. So right. It's tricky.
But
the payment is the whole tricky part. Yeah.
But if they're listed through Ingram.
If they're listed through Ingram or Baker and Taylor. I've known plenty of independent people who publish through both of those. The real problem is ebooks, because there's basically a monopoly at work when you come to that. Independently published people really can't get into the old Overdrive world, and they certainly can't get into the Hoopla world, and that's what we use. There's 3M. I think it's also kind of difficult to get in with them. So getting your ebook into the library, there are ways. We found a workaround at my library to do it, but it can be very hard.
I hadn't even...
Why is that, though? I mean...
We really don't have a bunch of people to choose from when it comes to ebooks and libraries. Overdrive is brilliant, and they really got a foothold on the market very early on. They know how to work with libraries. Hoopla is very smart, and they've managed to come up with simultaneous use, and that was a whole different thing. And also, their app, beautiful, beautiful, user-friendly, gorgeous little app. Can't help but love it. And other things have followed that model. Yeah, but when it comes to ebooks, you want to have access to the popular stuff, because that's what your patrons are going to want. And so that means working with the big guys. It means working with an Overdrive or a Hoopla. A little independent ebook provider isn't going to give you what your patrons want.
You mentioned Amazon a lot, and I was curious, through the years, how has the existence of Amazon changed the library scene? And I mean, I see that there are some positives in a way, because independents now can sell their books through Amazon to libraries through that. But what would you say?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. You've hit the nail on
the head. And negatives as well.
I have access to books I would never have been able to buy. And not just like the new editions. Like sometimes I have a patron who's like, look, there was this great book in 1985 and it's completely out of print. Can the library get it? And actually through Amazon, I could find it's a risk, but if I could find a third party dealer through Amazon and buy a super good condition version of that book that's reasonably priced, voila, I have that book for my patrons. So that's Amazon's real benefit. The problem becomes when Amazon starts getting into its own, it basically coming up with its own products. So Amazon publishing is not a problem because for whatever godforsaken reason, they sell through Baker and Taylor. But Audible, Audible. I literally had a conversation with a patron about this yesterday. They were like, hey, I heard there's this amazing audiobook. I've been checking your catalog every single day, trying to figure out if you're going to get this audiobook. It sounds amazing. And so I looked it up while she was on the phone. I'm like, it's Audible. Audible is unavailable to libraries in any way, shape, or form. And they snatch up books, really big name books and wonderful professional actors to read them. And you can't get them. You can't get them in the library. They have no library version because Amazon's not interested in libraries. They offer us no discounts. That's the real thing, is that Ingram and Baker & Taylor and all that, they offer us book discounts, which is great. Amazon doesn't do that. Amazon's not going to offer me any kind of a discount just because they're going to give me free shipping because I'm a library. So basically I have to, pay what I pay and, do it at their business level. And that gives me some discounts, but not a ton. So yeah, Amazon doesn't care about libraries and never has, and I would suspect never will.
They don't care independent about bookstores.
Yeah, they don't care about bookstores either. Amazon cares about Amazon. Right. And so as long as you're clear about that, we're all fine. But it means it's a problem. Actually, the biggest problem comes, also Amazon Prime, the videos. Because they will not only produce their own content on Amazon Prime, which will never come out on DVD and I can never purchase for my library, but they will also snatch up old TV shows, like let's say RuPaul's Drag Race, which was available on DVD and now isn't because now it's Amazon Prime. And now I can't provide that for my patrons in my library. Crazy, crazy. It's like, and I've had some people be like, well, what if we ripped it and then put it on a DVD and then put it in the library? I'm like, yeah, that'll work totally. I can't see any problem with it.
A bootleg at the library.
Seriously, I mean, the libraries try to come with all kinds of clever workarounds, but there's only so much we can legally do.
Has Amazon changed acquisitions in any way, or like the taste of what people are into, or,
It's funny. I mean, to a certain extent, Amazon has kind of helped in that a person will ask for something obscure, and I don't say yes to everything. I'm very open with what I buy, but if someone wants like an economic book from 1974, I'm going to be like, yeah, I don't think anyone else is going to. Also, if it's like way too expensive. So usually if it's cheap on Amazon, they'll be like, well, I'll just buy it for 10 cents off Amazon. I'm like, go to it. So a lot of the things that I just can't get for people, and that this is definitely... I live in a town where there's some money here. So people will just go off and buy the stuff themselves if I won't get it for them. But they always like to check with the library first because, that's how you become rich. So in that way, it's sort of changed acquisitions in a way. But mostly it's Prime. Prime and people finding out we just can't. But it's fine because then you just sit at the desk and you just both kvetch about Amazon and everybody's happy.
Right. Yeah, Amazon doesn't care if you complain about it. So
they don't care.
You were saying earlier, talking about different ways that you find books. Are there blogs or publications or that sort of thing where you will go to consistently to find indie books?
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's funny. Back when blogs were such a huge new thing, and they were erupting, I swear, in the mornings, I would read like 20 blogs a day, literally 20 blogs a day. I would go through boom, 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 boom. And just to get my recommendations from and everything like that. I don't do that anymore. And I don't think anybody does that anymore. In fact, I think a lot of people do what I do. And they now go through their social media sites. Mm-hmm. They go through their Facebook and they go through their Instagram. And they go through their Twitter. And you find the people who are talking about the kinds of books that you're interested in. And then you follow them. And they're the ones who are finding the stuff and recommending the stuff. And then you take those recommendations. I mean, once a day, practically, I'm taking screenshots off my phone so I can take them to work and be like, hey, this is a great book. We should check this out. I hadn't heard about this before. I'm getting recommendations from a bunch of different places. I get them from the newspapers to a certain extent. And then there's this newsletter that comes off out of Library Journal. And I think it's called Book Life, and I should really check that. But basically, they sum up all the media that have been talking about books in some way. And I'm not just talking like NPR, talk to this person, and the New York Times really highlighted these four books. They do that. But they will be like, oh, on these four morning shows, here were the four books, the authors that they spoke to. And this, and here's like what Bustle is talking about. Here's what this website's talking about, And they put it all in one place and they send it to you daily. And then, here's all the movies based on books that are going to be coming out. Or here's the movies, the books that have just sold their movie rights. So look for those, this is sold to Netflix. So look for this in the future. so useful because I don't know where my patrons get their book recommendations. It's NPR. But I, you know, so this actually will kind of like help me be ready. But it, you know, but that tends to be the bigger things. It doesn't tend to be the independently published things. So those I tend to rely on the trusted people I found over the years on these different platforms. And then I just follow them there. And then if they have a blog, they'll usually put it on Twitter. I'll see it there and then I'll follow it to their blog and I'll read about it there.
Yeah. Can we kind of jump in a little bit to author events?
I remember when those used to happen. Those were great.
Yeah, right. Eventually, hopefully, we will get back to those.
Yes, I think we will.
Yeah. Yeah, but even now, I've seen some of my local libraries doing things with local authors with readings and things like that.
Like, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We just had we pair with our local bookstore. It'll be a library and bookstore pairing, and we've had some amazing authors in the last few months. Yeah.
When people are approaching a library, to possibly do an event, what should they keep in mind?
That's a really good question. So I have done library events, it's funny, traditionally collections and programming are two entirely different beasts and the two just aren't, do not mix, but you have to work together to a certain extent, because if you have an event with this author and then you don't have any copies in the library, that looks bad. So. And this happens actually pretty regularly at my library. Instead of a communication issue, I'll be walking to the lobby and we'll put these big posters up of like, oh, this author is coming to speak. And I'll look at it and look at the book and then I will take a picture of it, go up to my desk and see if we have any copies. So when an author though comes in and they, well, first of all, find out who to speak to about it. Don't just come to the first clerk on the desk and be like, I want to do an event. Like, ask, who is the person who organizes your events? I would like to speak to them. I'm an author. I would like to do an event here. And then they will direct you to whoever that person might be. And then you can do the whole pitch on, you know, it's great if you're in your own town. That's almost a gimme. That's like if an Evanston author walks to the door and says, I'm Evanston, give me a thing. Then we're pretty much going to say yes. But if you are going in like a nearby town, then a person can broaden it and be like, I'm Illinois. I'm an Illinois local author. And it's like, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have a PowerPoint presentation, if you have any elements, like maybe you come with live music, that's cool. You know, anything that kind of makes you a little different, you don't have to. I do remember seeing, I think it was an SCBWI conference where like, three authors were like all juggling at once and people were like, do I have to learn to juggle to write a children's book? Yes. But no, the problem with being an author, the whole reason you became an author was that you could sit in a dark room and you could type and no one would bother you. And now you're supposed to be in front of like a crowd of people. Right. Watch other people present their books. I cannot stress that enough. I wish that the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators would to have an event where an authors can go into schools and watch other authors present for kids. Mm-hmm. Because if you are pitching yourself to a library, that's one thing. If you're pitching yourself to a school, that is an entirely different beast. And if you're pitching yourself to a bookstore, that's a different thing entirely too. And be prepared for no one to show up. Because literally you can be the most famous person in the world and you have three people show up. It happens to the most famous authors. Everybody has dealt with this. Get in good with the staff because maybe they will bring you cookies.
And then you'll have someone to talk to and eat cookies.
And then you'll have someone to talk to. That often is what happens. I'll just engage like some poor staff member. I'll sit there with my pile of books and there's nobody in sight and I'll talk to them. And then someone comes up with your book and you're like, oh, and then you direct your attention to the person. But it fills the time and it makes you look, I'm like a very busy person. I've got places to go and people to see and people want to talk to me left and right. Yeah, it's a whole thing. It's a lie.
Approaching libraries as an indie, just like bookstores, it's all very piecemeal, right? It sounds like go to this one and then go to that one.
Yeah, there's not one single, even if you're in a consortium, there's not one library you can go to. And then unless you're working with like something like Chicago Public Library, but I don't even know if they send people from branch to branch. I don't think they do. And I know New York Public Library didn't do that. That would be awesome. and they don't do it. So you're going to have to go to those branches individually and say, hey, can I present here? Hey, can I present here? Hey, can I present here? Yeah, there's no organized system in place.
So if you want to show your book to a library in another state, there's probably a much less likely chance of being accepted because there's no regional affiliation.
Unless there is a regional tie of some sort that might interest them. For example, if I wrote a book about Kalamazoo, I might go to the Kalamazoo Public Library and be like, hello, I wrote a book about your town. It's called Kalamazoo, the Kalamazooist Kalamazoo and the Kalamazoo. Could I do a book thing for you with you guys? And that they think they'd be very interested in. But if you don't have a regional tie, if you're just some schmuck off the street, I'm not saying they won't say yes, but you're going to really have to sell it to them because they've got a bunch of local people that are kind of in line first. And it's a lot of work for the library. I mean, because if you've got technology needs, they got to make sure that technology works. They're going to be doing your advertising to a certain extent, though they're going to want you to help. But they'll be the ones like promoting you. And you might want to have some references if you've done something somewhere else, honestly. Just because I know I have had authors come in and do a presentation and I'm just sitting there like, do I cut this off or not? I actually don't know. Because they don't know you from Boo. So you can be crazy.
But in terms of acquisitions, is it much less likely as well to be acquired by a library in another state?
Yes, it is. Unless you've got a topic that they're really interested in that really fills a gap. And so if you've already written that book, you might want to try to figure out what that gap is. Like, well, you just don't have a lot of, feminist books that involve mud wrestling for 5-year-olds. So, you know, that's a gap. And it could be they've been looking for that, you know.
A real niche market.
You don't know. Yeah. So, you know, you gotta be a salesman to a certain extent. And you know, there's something to be said for taking classes and how to do sales. You know, how to sell yourself, how to sell your book.
Yeah, it's interesting because the indie world is just so different than the traditional world, right? Like the traditional world depends on sales to schools and libraries and things like that to stay afloat. But the indie world is just like hand selling and the hustle.
Yeah. And, you know, the indie world, you know, like Kirkus, if you pay the money, you could get a book reviewed with them. And that'll work with some libraries who are like, you need a professional review. And you're like, allow me to show you my Kirkus review. And they're
I pay $350 for.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, what is that review worth to you? Because if you are the kind of person who's just going to be selling this like insanely, then that's actually a good investment. If that's your full-time job, getting your book into libraries, then you have to have that review because there are a lot of libraries that still insist on having one professional review. So that might actually pay off for you in the end.
And it has to be a good review.
Well, there is that because Kirkus don't guarantee. Yeah. But I do find they're a bit kinder to their paid reviews than they are to the ones that are just submitted from the publishers. Yeah.
Hmm. So is that sort of unfair though?
It's unfair to the major publishers. but I suppose. I mean, I'm not saying they'll lie. It's just they won't be caustic.
Yeah, they won't be horrendous.
They love being caustic. So they're like, ooh, this will really get them. It's like, oh, yeah.
Or I review sometimes,
Kirkus, so I know the way, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Kirkus and their problems.
Oh, Kirkus. I love them, though. I do.
I've heard things from other libraries and stuff that sometimes they're just like, oh, independent people, they should just donate a copy to our library.
Ooh, yeah, and they're gonna, and it's like, you're gonna get no money from that. And yeah, exactly. It's not going to help you. You know, we actually participate, well, there's Indie Authors Day, and then there's the Indie Author Project. So we do a little bit with that, but what we really do is we've got a program here with BiblioBoard where we purchase something from them called press books and self-e, where you can format your book and it looks gorgeous. Like we've got this program, you can literally take anything you want and format it and it looks like a professional book. And then you submit that ebook to something called self-e and it gets sent to Library Journal. and they will read through all these books, and then they will highlight some. And then so on our BiblioBoard site, where all these ebooks are, if they like yours, they'll promote it like in every BiblioBoard and every library that has access to it, which is fantastic.
Wow.
So this is how we try to promote the ebooks of independent authors. And you can even link to your Amazon page from that ebook page on BiblioBoard. And some people have really gotten quite popular. Some people have been picked up by actual publishers through this system. The trick being, you have to have a library that participates, and you know, not every library does. We do. And I'm very fond of the program.
Does that go for picture books as well, or is that more for novels?
That is, it does have children's books. I don't think picture books as much, no. Mm-hmm. They are looking to expand at least the Self-E program into children's books and nonfiction, which they don't do nonfiction either. But they, I don't think they have quite yet. I think COVID slowed them down a little bit. But yeah, no, I don't think, that's a good point. I don't think they do picture books, but I do think they do older readers. They definitely do YA, I can tell you that. It, you know, if you submit your book to the Self-E program and they like it, then they're promoting you to in libraries all around the country, including some major ones. So,
but
and
yeah,
Canada, it's like, I think actually Canada as well.
There's just so much competition for our attention.
Well, exactly. Right. And it's hard.
I mean, even the my traditionally published friends are just like, oh, this marketing stuff, you know, like they're constantly pushing. And
well, exactly, because unless you are the golden child of this season of this huge publisher, they're not gonna do much. I remember my first picture book, which was Giant Dance Party, and that was with HarperCollins. I think I got bookmarks. I felt pretty good about that. Didn't get any much of anything else, but I got some freaking bookmarks, which are around here somewhere. I will find them. But that, yeah, I didn't get bookmarks for any other book. So I didn't know what I had. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes they send me places. A lot of the times they don't. You know, they'll ask, their marketing team will say to you, what's your marketing plan? Oh, great. Okay, sure.
Well, is there anything else that you feel like authors need to know about libraries?
I think it behooves you to talk to the right person. And I said that in terms of programming, but that goes for collections as well. Find out the best person to speak to, because there are some people who have a prejudice against indie authors, like right off the bat. Like you walk up to that children's desk, you don't know that person's attitude. They might think, oh, independent authors are nothing. They're just people. They're people who couldn't get published by a traditional publisher, blah, 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 blah. And then there's other people who are very open to it. And they're like, oh no, I understand the changing face of publishing. I understand what's going on. So you need to find the right person to talk to. And I don't know if that consists of going up to the desk, talking to the person about children's books, like, what's your take on indie authors? Like, ask them, for God's sake. And if they're like, bleh, then like, great, who else works here? Who else? What else you got? Because, or find out who does the children's purchasing, because it's not me, actually. I've got someone who does it for me, and I work with them. But often, you know, Brian, who does my children's purchasing, he buys indie authors all the time. He's very open to it. So, you know, if you met Brian and Brian, for whatever reason, wasn't into that, then you could reach out to me. I get some people who send, like, emails about their books to the head of our publicity of the library, my library director, my assistant library director, my head of funds, myself, the head of technical services. So they'll just, like, send everyone one. I hate to say it, but then what happens is everyone forwards those emails to me, and I pay a lot more attention. I don't want to, like, advise you to do that. It kind of works sometimes. So, you know, maybe not five or six people, but maybe, like, you know, four people. That's not a bad idea, because if I get more than one email, I pay more attention.
So it should be sent to the person in charge of purchasing and acquisitions. Is that?
Yeah, the smartest people to send it to are the people who actually might buy the book. The head of purchasing, the head of acquisitions, head of collections. The specialist. Now my library is weird because even though we are rather large, we're not tiny. I am the only purchaser of adult. I have one person who does my teen for me and one person who does my children's for me. In normal libraries in the suburban Chicago area, you've got 5, 6, 7 purchasers in a department, and that might be just adult. And they might not be any bigger than me, but you'd have someone who does all the mysteries, someone who does all the, you know, the science fiction, someone who does the nonfiction children, someone who does the fiction children, someone who does the picture books. So that's what you really got to kind of figure out is who's doing the purchasing, how many people are there, and which one would do my kind of book.
Right. And what are the chances all those people are listed on the website?
Oh, not a, like, zero is zero. 0% chance. Zero. That you got to, again, got to do the legwork. You got to walk into that little library and ask some questions. And they're usually super friendly about it. So
if
they're not, find someone else.
Right.
How is the purchaser, I guess I thought the person in charge of acquisitions purchased the books. Like, how is it different? Like,
yeah, it's, so I'm, well, and see, acquisitions is different from collections, just to make everything completely, even though the word acquisition
should
be the same as collection, but acquisitions in my library means paying the bills for the items and receiving the items and dealing with the physical items themselves, whereas collections is a person who's building the collection in some way, like buying the materials. So it's, see, this is the problem with libraries. We got this whole like secret library speak, and then people try to speak our language and we're like, we do not understand your terms. They are not the terms that we use. Have a card catalog.
This is all good to know though.
It can be very helpful. So yeah, but I am the head of collections. I could just not buy anything. I could just, usually, I mean, a lot of times the head won't even do the purchasing. They'll just have everyone else do it for them.
Now, how do you, because you read so, I'm sure, so many books. And how do you quickly, like, what are the standouts when you look through a book? Even if you're not, like, fully reviewing it, but what can you gain from it from a quick read, or how do you go about that process?
So there's two different types of books in a way that I sort of separate them out. There's, like, the picture books, the nonfiction picture books, you know, the easy books, the poor books, the books that aren't going to take too much of my time. Mm-hmm. Those are easy. I mean, if they're bad, they didn't last very long, and I didn't commit that much time to it, and I don't spend time going like, why did I waste minutes of my life reading this? Picture books are great. I love them. If there's a ton of text and it seems too long, it better be engrossing, or I'm just not going to continue with it. So, but a lot of the time, I'll just finish it. I'm like, it's like 32 pages. This is nothing. I will read it and maybe it'll surprise me. There was a book out this year where I was just like, well, it had gotten a star in Kirkus, and I was like, yeah, I don't know. And then I got to the, like, very literally the last image, and I was like, oh, it is good. Okay. So I'll give them, in a way, I give them a great deal of chance when they're short. If they're long, whether it's a long nonfiction for kids book or a middle grade novel or, God help my soul, a YA. So that's the real question. And this especially comes up on review committees, where committees are determining what books to consider for awards. The standard line can sometimes be at the extreme end that you give it 50 pages. But in a realistic world, with the so many books that are coming out, 20 pages is probably more realistic. You gotta hook the reader in 20 pages. So you might be thinking like, well, but my books are sprawling epic and you need to set up all this stuff at the early parts. No, you're gonna lose us. You're gonna lose us. Maybe if you are just a really, really good writer and we've already read stuff that you've done, we might be willing to go along with you on that journey. But if you are establishing your name and your brand, then you need to hook the reader early. I mean, kids, as I like to say, aren't polite for the sake of being polite. If they are bored, they will put your book down and they will not read it. And when they're standing in that bookstore or standing in that library and they've taken your book and they've looked at it and they've been like, well, this might be good, and they're flipping through those first few pages to see if they want to read more, you gotta hook them. Because if you do not hook them at that moment, that child is going to be like, nope, and put it right back. And not, that book will never be read. And if it's never read, then it ends up on our dead on arrival lists and it's gone.
So in a way, picture book authors and illustrators have an advantage because people might give them more of a chance.
Yes, very much so. Because even if they're bad, the thinking is like, yeah, but they don't last long. Pain is swift. Yeah. So yeah, no, they do have an advantage. However, their disadvantage is there are so many picture books as opposed to middle grade novels. There really aren't as many middle grades. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot, but nothing compared to picture books. Picture books, the sheer numbers have just increased and increased and increased and increased over the last few years to the point where it's almost ridiculous. I'm like, especially because I'll get a book from a major publisher and I'll be like, I have literally read this book 500 times. There is nothing new here. The art is not new. The text is certainly not new. Why did you make this? You have wasted so much. The trees. So you don't want that. You want a book that's not a waste of space. And just got to work on that part. Easy peasy.
Wow. Right. How many books? I mean, estimated ballpark. Children's picture.
Okay, let me think this through. A number of years ago, the Society of Illustrators, which does a wonderful exhibit in New York City every year, they have an annual art show from all these children's books. And the art, if they accept it, is sent in and then displayed on the walls, and you can walk around and look at this art firsthand. And it is amazing. It's the best thing. One of the judges, and this was 6 years ago, I want to say, was saying, oh, the numbers have really gone up because we got 700 submissions this year. And that was 6-7 years ago. And I can guarantee you that there are more small publishers since then who are doing picture books, and big publishers have not cut down on the number of picture books. And then you've got people who are doing e-picture books on top of that as well. Mm-hmm. So that just number has just skyrocketed. So I don't know.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
That's thank you.
Yeah, it was fun to do.
What are you thinking, Ai-Jung?
I thought that was good.
Yeah.
I thought that was extremely informative, and there's just so much information. I'm going to have to re-listen to this podcast.
I agree. But I love this kind of solid, here's what you do sort of information.
Yeah.
Right? Because it points me in a direction and gives me some of the tools.
Definitely. And when we were talking about how it's kind of like learned sales, you know, as she was talking about the emails and how to approach her and stuff, I was thinking about, like, I've taken some courses in selling wholesale, and those are the same lessons. It's like, research the place you want to sell. Find out something about them, mention that, find out that person's name. You know, it makes sense, but it seems like it should be obvious, but it's not to most people.
Right.
Because most people don't realize that checking out your work and investing the time and energy into it takes effort. So, like, why would they take effort if you're not really putting that much effort, you know?
Right. Yeah. In a way, it's like, if you were to receive an email from a stranger asking you to do something, what yeah. would you like it to say?
Right. It's so true. Yeah. There's a lot to think about.
Yeah. And, you know, my book's not done yet, of course, but it's really good information to have now to be thinking about it so that I'm not scrambling to try to learn it after I already have a book out.
Yeah, that was so good to know. And yeah, libraries definitely are weirdly mysterious for such public places. Now. Yeah, yes. Oh gosh. Yeah. So getting those specifics, getting the context, getting all that in place. It is a lot of work. Right. So, and also, I mean, it's somewhat discouraging, but it's nice to know the truth that, you know, getting your independently published book in another state's library might be not as easy or right. not as, maybe that's a route you don't put as much energy into. But I think it's good to know that.
So. Right. Well, I'm going to go do some thinking.
Me too. Thank you, people who are listening. Yes.
Thanks, everyone.
And we do have an Instagram, Picture Book Path. On Instagram, yes. One word, Picture Book Path. So.
And on Twitter, Picture Book Path on Twitter too.
Yeah.
We're all over the place. All right.
Yep.
Thanks.
All right.
Picture Book Path is hosted by Ijun Kim and Philip Hilliker. We can be reached at picturebookpath@gmail.com. Our music is by scottholmesmusic.com.